The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Tonight we are pleased to host Elias Corey and Sinan Antoon. Elias Corey, who was here last summer to discuss his novel Gate of the Sun, joins us this evening to read from his most recent work, Yallo, described by Haaretz and many other papers as a heartbreaking book, hypnotic in beauty. Elias Corey is the author of 12 novels, 4 volumes of literary criticism, and 3 plays. His best-known work, the aforementioned Gate of the Sun, was named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and won the prestigious Palestine Prize. Corey is currently the editor-in-chief of the cultural supplement of Beirut's daily newspaper, An Nahan, and is a global distinguished professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic studies at New York University. Our first speaker this evening also teaches at New York University, where he lectures on Arabic literature. Sinan Antoon was born in Iraq in 1967 and left in 1991 after the Persian Gulf War. While I'm sure many things happened to him in between those dates, I have no idea what they were. Perhaps we'll find out later. I do know that he did graduate studies at Georgetown and Harvard, where he earned a doctorate in Arabic literature. In the summer of 2003, Sinan returned to Baghdad with the D.C.-based collective Encounter Productions, to co-direct About Baghdad, an acclaimed documentary about Iraq under U.S. occupation. Some of you may have seen the film when it screened a few years ago at the Philadelphia International Film Festival. His novel, Ijam, an Iraqi Rhapsody, was recently published in English, and his most recent book, Baghdad Blues, a Book of Poetry, was published by Harbor Mountain Press. None other than Elias Corey describes Ijam as a brilliant and beautiful novel that expresses the voice of those voices who were robbed by oppression, stressing the fact that literature can at times be the only framework to protect human experience from falling into oblivion. Please welcome Sinan Antoon.
Thank you, Andy, for the introduction, and thank you for the organizers. I'm happy to be here, especially with Elias, who is a dear friend and someone I look up to. I should say a few things about the premise of the novel before I read parts of it. Something about the Arabic language and the Arabic script is important to understand the novel. The Arabic script consists of 8 letters, half of which have 1, 2, or 3 dots. Now, initially, the script was written without the dots because the dots could be guessed from the syntax and from the context, but later were added. The premise of my novel is that a manuscript is found in one of the security complexes in Baghdad in the late 80s, and the manuscript is found to be without dots, written without dots, and then someone from the secret police is assigned the task of adding the dots to kind of ascertain what kind of meaning. Because with the absence of the dots, there would be possibility for puns and a lot of wordplay. So the prisoner is taken into prison without knowing the reason. And one of the jailers tells him, you know, I'm forced to work with these people. I'm a good person. The least I could do is I could give you some paper so that you would write. And the narrator thinks that this is maybe just a trick to further torture him. So he's reluctant to write, but then he thinks if he writes without dots, then it would be really difficult to make out exactly what he's saying. So that's the premise of the novel. And there's a kind of a slippage in time and space, back and forth, between him being inside and trying to record his experience inside, and him trying to reconstruct his memory, which has been damaged because of the trauma of torture. So I will read the opening section. Two clouds kissed silently in the Baghdad sky. I watched them flee westward, perhaps out of shyness, leaving me alone on the bench beneath a French palm tree, so called because it stood in the courtyard in front of the French department. to wait for Arij. I looked for something worth reading in that morning's Al-Jumhuriyya, the daily paper, and found a good translation of a Neruda poem in the culture section, besieged on all sides by doggerel barking praise of the party and the revolution. The breeze nudged the palm fronds above my head to applaud. It was April, the month of fecundity, the birth of the Ba'ath and the leader, as one of the posters on the college walls announced. Good morning. I longed to hear the warm, milky voice of Arij, but this was not hers. It was the voice of Abu Umar, the security officer enrolled as a student in the English department. He wore gray pants and an open-collared shirt. Accompanying him was another member of his species, short, long-faced with a thick mustache. This one wore a blue safari suit, the fashion of choice for all mukhabarat, secret police, regardless of season or occasion. Comrade Salah, said Abu Umar, introducing the short man and elongating the final A of his samurai accent to make it sound closer to its Tikriti variation. Abu Umar's reddish mustache reminded me of the cockroaches that invaded our bathroom at night, thwarting our every eradication campaign. Like most of his colleagues, Abu Umar never made any effort to conceal his occupation. He rarely attended classes, and his age, he was in his late 30s, was a clear sign that he wasn't an ordinary college student. In times of war, graduates were immediately conscripted, and except for graduate students who had secured special permission to continue their studies, no one could linger in college to change disciplines or get a second degree. Abu Umar, however, transferred to the English department halfway through the academic year after he had spent 3 years in the Arabic department. Comrade Salah would like to ask you a few questions, he said. I couldn't hide my anxiety, but I answered with an unhesitant, of course. Salah smiled viciously and asked me to come with him. Where? To the office. It won't take more than half an hour. I had thought a great deal about this moment, but could never seem to summon discretion enough to avoid it. Abu Umar gathered the books and stacked on the bench beside me and put them in my hands. We walked toward the main gate. I had always complained about the distance between the gate and the lecture halls, but that morning, as we crossed the nearly empty courtyard, the walk seemed mercilessly short. It was early still. I like to arrive before most students to avoid Baghdad's morning crowds and traffic. I looked around for a familiar face, perhaps someone to record my absence, but found none. I thought of Arij and her incessant murmurs of caution. I thought of my grandmother with her endless praying and the candles she lit in church after church for my safety. We crossed the courtyard that separated the English department from the dean's office, passed by the student union, and turned left toward the main entrance. Through the iron gate, I could see a Mitsubishi with tinted windows. It was parked beneath the mural erected in honor of the leader's honorary doctorate in disorder. It was a doctorate in law, but that's the pun there. He wore a university gown and held a degree in his hand. The inscription read, quote, "The pen and the gun have one barrel." The Ministry of Rupture and Inflammation, which is upon the Ministry of Culture and Information, would daily bombard us with slogans and chants, and I retained my sanity by rearranging their words and images to better suit my mood. I began with some political songs, which could be improved with a simple stroke. In the name of the people and the nation, I unsheathed my invisible pen and began to improve my superior's verses. House by house, our leader calls on us and fucks us into bed. The song, of course, is originally Tucks Us Into Bed. When we reached the car, a man emerged from the driver's side and opened the back door. Salah motioned for me to get in. I gave Abu Umar a contemptuous look and climbed onto the seat. It was clear that he would not be coming with us. Salah slammed the door shut and sat down next to me while another man, bald, with sunglasses, sat beside the driver. The car left the college in the direction of Al-Waziriyya. We passed a bookstore where I sometimes shopped, turned right at the Muhammad Al-Qasim Expressway and south towards the stadium. On the radio, the announcer read the morning news. A drop of sweat fell from my forehead onto the right lens of my glasses, mocking my attempt at composure. It was the first time I had felt real fear since the first days of the war when Iranian jets thundered above Baghdad and dropped their bombs by the hundreds. The expressway ran over an old cemetery where it is said the grave of Zubaydah, wife of Harun al-Rashid, lies, or perhaps another Zubaydah of more recent demise. The image of the Syrian actress who played Zubaydah in the television series about Harun al-Rashid imposed itself on my mind, along with the lyrics of Nazm al-Ghazali, also buried in that cemetery. Those who threw me, those that tortured me, on a distant bridge have left me. What lies ahead for me? Sarmad was right to warn me. Did someone write a report? Did they hear me doing my impression of him? My grandmother was right. Please be careful, my son. For my sake, what would I do if anything happened to you? I'd surely die. They'll cut out your tongue. These people don't fear God. They fear nothing. Salah interrupted her to answer my question. Could he hear her too? We have very much enjoyed your ideas, and we'd like to hear more of them, he said with evident sarcasm. Glancing down at the cemetery as we quickly left it behind, he added, and your famous sense of humor. What do you mean? You know very well what I mean. We too know things, you see. He smiled. The car left the expressway at Al-Nidal Street. I knew we were heading towards general security. The drops of sweat began to multiply on my forehead, and my heart beat with a tribe of drums running one after another. The car crossed through the empty streets of the quiet neighborhood that surrounded the security complex. We passed a young girl riding a bicycle near the Iraqi National Symphony, which I knew was close to the security complex. I used to joke about this harmonious coincidence of Baghdad's geography. The car slowed to let the girl complete her turn, and I could see her mother outside of their door screaming and waving her arms. Salah motioned for the driver to enter through gate 3. After a few minutes, we stopped at a tall entrance guarded by 3 armed men. When they recognized the car, they removed that iron shark's jaw that lies in front of every government building. As the gate opened, the driver and the guards exchanged greetings and the car began to move again. Inside, Salah asked the driver to stop and open the trunk. The long street stretching in front of us was flanked on the left by a high wall topped with barbed wire and cameras. Salah got out of the car. I heard the sound of the trunk latching shut. He returned with a white cloth in his hands and began to put it over my eyes. I reached out to resist, but he forced my hands down. If you move again, I swear to God I'll crush your teeth. I heard the scraping of the gate as it closed behind us. The last thing I saw was the leader's face staring at me from Salah's Swiss watch. I reached up again to stop him and felt a fierce blow at the back of my head. I don't remember what happened afterward. The second excerpt I'd like to read is one of those nightmares that punctuate the novel that the narrator has as he is trying to write and he's afraid of being discovered that he's writing. I dig in the silence, searching for a yet deeper silence to burrow into. But the screaming assaults me again. I smear the walls with my insanity, as if to ward off the screams that creep nearer and nearer. Screams mingled with a mocking laughter. I am laughing too. And then I cry. I see a tall door in front of me, stretching from the floor to the ceiling. I reach to open it. A long path appears lined with trees in whose thick branches rustle all the letters of the alphabet. As I step onto the path, a storm wind blows. I hear a murmuring in the branches. The dots of the letters are falling from the trees like autumn leaves, and the letters are left as bare as branches. The letters fall too, each pronouncing its own sound as it strikes the ground. The wind calms and silence once again unfolds itself. The letters are changing color from black to dark green to light green. They begin to stir, spinning in spirals on the path. There are grasshoppers turning and jumping. They spring into the trees. They are locusts. They bite hungrily into the branches. They swallow trees whole. The wind howls again, pushing me back inside. The door closes and fades away, but I can still hear the locusts ruining the silence. And another excerpt. I lay nude on my back on top of the white sand and below the deep black sky. The moon hiding behind a dark cloud began to shed drops the color of ink. I felt the cold drops dotting my body and wiped one that had fallen on my forehead and another that rested on my chest. My fingers blackened. A howl reached my ears from the distance. I arose and looked around me, but saw only the inky rain that spotted the sand, whose rhythm had sped up into a downpour. I heard the howl nearing, followed by barking and the roar of what sounded like an engine. Fear seized me and propelled me in the opposite direction. The shower became a deluge, and the rain began to gather into small lakes that I would jump over as I ran with all my strength. I fell, and the rain-blackened sand stained my cheeks, my chest, my thighs. I wiped my face and rose again, running away from the howling and roaring. I turned, looking for the source of the sounds, and saw my footsteps writ clearly on the white sand. I thought about burying myself in it and hiding, but the dogs, whose howling and barking now approached, would smell me. I ran and ran until fatigue overcame me, and I fell, panting, on my face. The roaring stopped, and I heard the opening and closing of car doors and footsteps. Suddenly, bright lights appeared, coming from flashlights held in the hands of men leading the dogs. I ran again between the bars of light and heard their footsteps running behind me. After a short while, the cold and fatigue overcame me, and I collapsed again. The parallel bars of light lit the entire desert. The men released their dogs. They ran along the blinding rays. I tried to stand again and run, but I felt an unbearable pain in my feet and head. I crawled like an animal searching for a place to die. The barking was close by. I turned to find the dog ready to pounce. Its fangs shone, and I saw its pink gums lined with black. I hid my hand behind my hands. I opened my eyes to find the white page in front of me with its black lines stretching out from my head. Do I write? And one last short excerpt. This is where the, maybe some of you are familiar with the Arabic script, but this is where the narrator kind of imagines that he is visited by the entire Arabic alphabet. So there are references to the shape of the letters, but if you don't know them, you can imagine. I heard the sound of a door opening in the darkness, and Elif, first letter, and Elif fell through it, prancing and letting off a purple light. It stood in front of me and plucked the hamza from on top of its head, tipping it to me like a cap. He threw it behind him and plunged into the wall that had become a mirror. He bowed to me with respect and signaled to the ba, second letter, who was poking out his head to enter. The ba came and bowed and then went in, and behind him the ta and the tha. They all dropped their dots when they bowed, and afterward they would look in the mirror and laugh, dancing and spinning in giddy circles. Each of the letters of the alphabet followed, the jim, the ha, and the kha, the dal and dal, the ra and the zain, the sin and the sheen. The laughter rose and the dots fell, one after the other. The letters that take no dots began to pick them up from the ground and put them in their buttonholes or on their heads, or to stand on them and look at themselves in the mirror. One began to fight with the others and stole their dots. The sin stole sheen's dots and then raised its fingers to its lips with a loud shh. The mim lay down on his stomach and raised his head to swallow the two dots he had picked up off the ground. A lustful laughter swelled up, and the letters danced together, coupling in forbidden positions. Then the mirror broke, and soldiers raided the party, felling the letters with a spray of gunfire, and I awoke to find myself there. With parentheses around the T to maybe it's here, maybe it's there. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. This was Sinan Antun, so I must be Elias Khoury. I'm really happy to be here and to be with you, and to be especially with Sinan, and especially after he read this very beautiful piece about the dancing letters. I hope that the letters will dance when we write them. Normally, it takes us a lot of work to make them dance from time to time. Now I'll be reading a small part of my new novel, Yalu, and actually it's very difficult to summarize a novel, and it's very difficult for the writer to speak about his own work, but I must say something. So This is a novel dealing with the story of a young Lebanese man who is one of the sons of the Lebanese Civil War. He comes from a small community, which is the Syria community, and he was he went all through the Civil War. He's coming from a family. His grandfather was a priest who immigrated from Turkey to Syria and then to Lebanon after a massacre took place in the beginning of the century against the Syriacs. Normally we don't know about this massacre because it is overshadowed by the huge massacre which was committed against the Armenians in 1915 in Ottoman Turkey. And so the story is about this boy who was imprisoned in Beirut after he was accused of raping a woman and stealing. But actually he was imprisoned not because of that, because they suspected that he was part of a gang that was putting explosives in Beirut. And so he went through torture, all types of torture, which will finish by making him sit on a bottle of Coca-Cola. And the ultimate torture was that they obliged him to write his life story. They gave him papers and they asked him to write his life story, and of course he's not a writer. So every time he will write a version of that story, they will take him back to torture and beat him and oblige him to rewrite his story. So the novel actually is a kind of rewriting this story the way this boy who was obliged to write as part of a torture, and the torturers thought that through obliging him to write they will destroy his psychology. So actually he was destroyed through writing, and then little by little he will reconstruct himself and he will reconstruct his story, and the outcome is this novel. So I will be reading one part of these versions of his life story, which will give you an idea about how the novel is structured and how it is worked out. Now, the last thing I want to say is that in order to write this novel, I had to study the Syriac language, because I don't know the language. And this boy also did not know the language, but he lived in a family which spoke Syriac at home. So I thought I must study this language in order to be familiar and to match him a little bit. But I finished knowing it better than him. But he is better than me in many other ways, because he has traveled to many languages. Now he can speak many languages, which I cannot. He's in English and in French and in Norwegian and in Swedish and so on and so forth, languages which I do not know. And he traveled better than me. And you will see his English is very good, because it's not me who has written this English. It was translated by Peter Thoreau. And so let's try to enter this atmosphere with him. I want to write, but I'm lost. When I write about my life, must I write about my grandfather, my mother, and my father, or about my life that concerns me alone? I do not know. You want everything, especially the stories of the village, the woman, and the explosives. I think the story should begin with these events, but I cannot. Because ever since when? Since the Katzak? No. Since the Bastinado? No. Since the throne? No. Since the torture I experienced? I cannot distinguish between the beginning and the end. By the way, I can only congratulate you on your original methods of torture and your ability to extract a suspect's confessions as if you were extracting his soul. That is, he feels as if his soul is leaving his body and he is back in his mother's belly, which makes him confess everything. Though the torture is violent, the bodily signs of it vanish quickly, leaving only the spiritual traces that make you feel that your soul is about to leave you. I congratulate you, sir, especially for the bottle. The bottle is the conclusion after which there is no conclusion because it's long. I mean, it makes time long, even endless. I sat on the bottle for about 1,000 hours, or 1,000 times longer than that. You say that it was just 30 minutes, and you are right, because you know more than I do, because you wear accurate Swiss watches on your wrists. Me, alas, no. But the bottle changed the meaning of time. I mean, I felt as if I were in eternity. That time was frozen, and that I was living the last moments of my life, yet that my life was long, never ending. I wanted it to end so that the pain would be over, but it stopped ending. That is eternity. I will not mention the pains that are still with me even now, especially when I go to the toilet. It's not polite to talk about these things, but the truth, and you want the truth is that what frightens me most is my feeling that I need a toilet. There I go back to experiencing eternity again, and I smell my own smell. And I feel that pain has a smell. Yes, pain has a smell. And its smell is shit. That's what I feel and what I smell. But I am very lucky. I feel that my grandfather's prayers for me were not in vain. One of the prison guards here told me that many suspects died from the bottle because it broke in their backsides and they got gangrene in their large intestines and all their insides grew inflamed. Thank God that did not happen to me. On the contrary, the bottle helped me a great deal. How can I explain to you? I don't know. But your experience with prisoners must have made you capable of understanding what I'm writing, for I was not the first to have ascended the throne of spiral glass, and of course, will not be the last. When I ascended the throne and the pain pierced me from bottom to top and from top to bottom, I was sure that I would die. I mounted it and death began. That is, I felt death. Death is violent and has a sound. Something explodes inside you, and you hear a sound no one else does. And after the sound, your body tingles, and you sense that you are being dragged beyond white sleep. You are not sleeping, but you float beyond sleep. And then it's over. Stop. Everything is dark, and it's over. That's exactly how it happened with me. I'm not lying. I'm telling the truth, sir. Something snapped, and I was beyond sleep. I mean, sleeping yet not sleeping, and then I woke up. You took me into eternity and made me understand the meaning of life, because I tasted death and drank it from the top and from the bottom. I want to say, sir, that through all of those experiences, when I reached the essence of things, I saw him before me. Would you believe, sir, that my grandfather, who was also my father, was waiting for me everywhere? What did I want with him and his absurd story? But death, sir, when death approaches, it imposes its conditions. Death means that we experience things we never experienced, and the stories we have heard become facts. When I approached death, I became my grandfather and my grandfather's grandfather and all the descendants of men. I speak now from experience. So my mission is very difficult. I cannot write you the stories of all mankind that I know, but I wouldn't know how to write them. Therefore, I ask the respected interrogator to be a little patient with me. I will be brief and get to the heart of the subject you are looking for. But I saw another heart, just as essential, that I cannot ignore. So I will write it with the fewest words possible in order to be truthful to myself and to my soul suspended there on the throne of death. When I thought that the story had to begin with my grandfather, I hated it. For I did not love my grandfather. He embodied cowardice and selfishness. My grandfather was afraid of everything, perhaps because his conscience reproached him so much after the death of my grandmother, Mary Samhu, God rest her soul, of whom it was said died because of him. My grandmother died before I was born, which was why my grandfather was imposed on my father to come and live with him in his house. I believe that my father couldn't bear it from the very first day, so he packed his things and fled the unbearable atmosphere of that house. He left because he never once felt that he was in a home of his own. The bed was not his bed, and the life was not his life, and the woman was not his woman. My grandfather claimed that he had discovered by chance that my father or my mother's husband was not Syriac, but an Arab from Aleppo, belonging to the Melkite Greek Catholic sect. Fine. What does that change? Where is the crime? And why did the priest not discover the truth before his daughter married the man? My grandfather killed my father and trampled his shadow. Do you know, sir, that I do not possess a photo of my father? He was even torn out of the wedding pictures. Nothing remains of him, even his name is gone, because I bear my grandfather's name. My identity card says that I am from the Abyad clan. So what I am supposed to say when even now I don't know the difference between a person being Syriac or Arab? A person is a person, and we all come from Adam, and Adam came from dust. So why all these tricks? I do not understand my grandfather's pains that made his mouth a graveyard of Christ's language. What kind of foolishness is that? What? Christ does not understand Arabic, Greek, or Latin? My grandfather's fear cannot be described. My mother said that it came from his childhood as a result of the massacre that was committed in the village of Ain Ward at the beginning of the 20th century. But I'm not sure of anything. Perhaps my grandmother's death was the cause. I heard the news of my grandmother from other people, not from my mother. My mother spoke only rarely of her mother, but I sensed the presence of a dark shadow hanging over the silent relations between my mother and grandfather. Suddenly, silence would fall between them, and they would converse without words. I understood that true dialogue between people goes on without talking. Words do not express things. They cover them over. Now, sir, I understand why writing is difficult for me, because what's being asked of me is that I cover up the story, and here I feel deficient. For whoever wants to write must possess a double text. He must dub speech over the silence. As to when speech is your life, you speak in silence. I understand, sir, that you are asking a man to write the story of his life for the purpose of ethics and retribution. But what's the use of my story? And why am I telling my grandfather's story instead of my own? Is it because the priest killed his wife? Is it true that Abel Abyad, known as Ephraim, killed his wife, and that was the cause of his fear of everything? The Kohno, the priest, used to say that a man's body was a temple of fear. God created for the soul a body of clay to calm its fear of fear or of God. But the corporeal temple became a new cause of fear because of the original sin. Man died because he sinned, and death is his greatest fear. We fear the body, therefore we must dissolve it before it dissolves our souls. We must restore it to its clay state and not be overly solicitous of it. See to it as a potter cares for his clay, by watering it and setting it in the sun. The body needs only water and a few vegetables cooked by the sun. All else is vanity. In the beginning, the priest tried to defend himself. He said that he didn't want the woman to suffer. But when suffering came after the disease spread to her bones, he didn't know what to do and had to get help from doctors. The woman was taken to the Greek hospital in Ashrafieh, where she died amidst doses of morphine, which failed to ease her suffering. Yalu did not understand the silence between the priest and his daughter, which constituted a dialogue between them, until he heard their neighbor, Madame Marie-Rose, threaten her husband by saying that she would let him die the way the priest let his woman die, without getting treatment for her. Yalu imagined the scene and saw it through his mother's eyes, and understood how a person could be capable of reading that which had been erased. When his grandfather described the massacre that took place in Tur Abdin, he said that he could read what had been erased. We have to learn how to read words that have been erased. That is our story. We, a people whose story is erased and its language erased. We, a people whose story is erased and its language erased. So if we do not learn how to read what has been erased, all will be lost. In the past, I did not believe the priest could read books erased by time and torn by history. But now I'm beginning to believe him, because I have seen Yalu read silence and erased words. My mother began to speak erased words before her image in the mirror was erased. She used silence so that the priest would understand that she knew. Yes, sir. It seemed that my grandfather left his wife to die. He took her to the doctor who diagnosed cancer in her left breast. But instead of checking her into the hospital to remove the affected breast, he took her home, bought a box of aspirin, and let her die. He told his daughter that there was no medicine for cancer and that it was better that the doctors not be allowed to cut up her body. His only concern was that she not suffer. But she suffered so much. Gabby did not use that expression, but she looked at her father and he read it in her eyes, and his tongue lost the power of speech. That day, my mother invented the language of silence and tried to use it to address Elias Hashem, but the tailor did not possess the gift of silence. Only Yalu learned it, and his relationship with his mother proceeded in silence. He came home and read her sorrow, solitude, and love for him in her eyes, and replied without speaking that he wanted to live his life and could do nothing for her. Gabby lost the taste for food. She told her son that the taste had stayed behind in the old house and that she had been unable to cook because she no longer could distinguish flavors. All foods now tasted the same to her, all having the flavor of brugel. That's how my father was at the end. And now maybe I am at my end and can no longer feel the taste of my mouth. Gabby did not tell her son how she answered her father when he said he had lost all taste, because she was afraid she might anger the priest in his grave. For the Kohno was greatly insulted when his daughter answered that he yearned for Kurdish flavors because he was a Kurd. Yalu did not know why his grandfather was so sensitive about the subject of his Kurdish origin. For his grandfather, when he came to Beirut fleeing his uncle in Al-Qamishli, spoke Arabic and Kurdish and became fluent in classical Syriac only here. He said that he had forgotten Kurdish as if it had been erased from his memory, even though he had spoken it when the Kurdish mullah came to their house to witness his son's rejection of his heritage. Was the story true, or did my mother make it up? I do not know. Thank you.
Thank you too, Sinan and Elias, for those intensely poetic readings. Why don't we start the questioning? Folks, the way it works here is that you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you, and that way everyone can hear the question. Would anyone like to start us off? Don't be bashful. You have the microphone. Begin, please.
Torture. I didn't think it was on. Torture is a theme in both your books. I believe that one has to have some understanding of the topic. How has torture affected you or someone very, very close to you that would make your descriptions so great? It's really for both of you.
I fortunately or unfortunately grew up in Saddam's Iraq under the Ba'athist regime, when the Ba'athist regime was supported by the United States. So there were always stories about people being tortured, and that was part of reality, even though you didn't see it right away. But I should say that as I was writing the novel, of course, I kind of had a crisis in that I myself had never been in prison. And I had this ethical dilemma whether I should write about this or not. So I started reading feverishly, actually, accounts and memoirs of people tortured all over the world, but especially the Human Rights Watch and other reports about Iraq, and collecting stories from people, but also reached the conclusion that it's actually the artist's task is to write about experiences that he or she themselves did not experience necessarily directly. But, you know, having read sufficiently about the topic, and also that's where imagination comes into play. But unfortunately, well, in the past we used to say that we come from a region where torture is the norm, but nowadays we can say in this country also that torture is a fact of life. So I don't know if I've answered your question,
yes,
but maybe Elias will.
Yes, that's good.
No, it's a fact of life. I think there are many types of torture. One of them is to read a bad novel. Now, to go back to the question about, I think writing must, if it's not a personal experience, it's a personal travel, it's a personal voyage, travel towards others, and in this case, in the case of this novel, first of all, we must put both novels in the category of what I call the literature of prison in modern Arabic literature, which is now very flourishing, and maybe it's the last literature of prisons in the world, except if we are waiting the Guantanamo experience to bring its literature. Personally, I come from Beirut, where we never had a dictatorship regime, but we had a society regime which collapsed. But before that, of course, when we were students, I was imprisoned several times and I was tortured several times. But nothing to compare with poor Yalo. Poor Yalo went through the ultimate tortures, which actually, in order to write this book, I had to collect testimonies, especially from friends coming from another Ba'athist country, which is Syria. You know, the Ba'ath, you have two versions of the Ba'ath. And once I was asked what's the difference between the two Ba'aths regarding literature, I said the Iraqi Ba'aths persecute writers, whereas the Syrian Ba'aths persecute readers. So actually I had to collect a lot of testimonies. Based upon these experiences, and the most terrible part of it was when I knew that this technique of obliging prisoners to write their stories is used.
It's very Chinese.
It's not an invention. It is not my imagination that created this situation. It is a real way of torture, although it's not the most dominant one. But it's a real way which actually pushes the prisoner to collapse. This is the ultimate technique in order to make the prisoner totally collapsing, and his soul is disintegrating. So now through writing, I think writing is a very, very terrible experience. And I think for me, writing this book was a terrible personal experience. Now, this doesn't mean that for the readers it will be terrible. It's a very nice book. But it was really terrible because I had to go through inside the skin of this young man and actually to experience and to feel with him. Because you cannot write about someone if you don't love the character. And really, I loved this boy. And I totally felt total identification with him. So it was really a very terrible personal experience.
Thank you.
What was the predominant mode of literary expression before the prison narrative that has come to dominate Arab literature?
No, Arabic literature is like all literature in the world.
Right, but so I'm thinking of something like the American Road novel, and now we're in a memoir phase. And I mean, obviously, there are many genres and styles. But
I'm saying that the prison literature is very important in the sense that through this literature, what we call the post-Mahfuzian, that is the modern which came after the great achievement. And literary works of Najib Mahfouz, the great Egyptian writer, the Nobel Prize Egyptian writer. Really, the post-Mahfouzian novel and introducing modernism to the Arabic novel began with an Egyptian novel, which was published in 1966 by an Egyptian writer whose name is Sana'a al-Ibrahim, entitled The Smell of It, and it was a prison literature. Then another phase of change in the modern Arabic novel took place with the novel of Abdurrahman Munif, East Mediterranean, 1972. Abdurrahman Munif is a Saudi writer, but he has nothing to do with this flourishing Saudi woman
Azar Nafisi
literature that is now a la mode in America because it's serious. So Abdurrahman Munif's novel East Mediterranean also was a turning point in the technique of writing of Arabic literature. So, and I would not pretend that Yalo is like this, but hopefully critics will say it's also a change in the techniques of literature. Now, in this sense, this kind of literature is very important because it's not only a testimony of what's going on, but it was an experimental field where the modern Arabic novel had to face changes in techniques and ways of writing and approaches and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Question? Yes, in the middle.
Thank you. Hi, I have a question for Lies. You said that you learned a new language for this novel, and I was wondering if it had any effect on your writing or your writing style, and also why you felt the need to learn a new language entirely.
Actually, it's a long story because we discover when you study a new language, first there are three major Semitic languages, Arabic, Hebrew, and Aramaic or Syriac. Now, Syriac, which was the language of Jesus Christ, was a major language in the region from Iraq to India in the 4th and 5th centuries, and it was a great cultural language, which actually was not disappeared only, but it was absorbed by Arabic because they are very, very similar. Now, in studying Syriac, I discovered that if you translate classical Syriac to Arabic, you will have the colloquial Arabic, the syntax of the colloquial Lebanese and Syrian and Palestinian and so on. Now, I don't want to enter this. This is a very specialized field. But I felt that, yes, studying a language to write a novel was part of my understanding of writing, because for me writing is a way to discover new things. I do not write about things I know. Actually, I write about things I do not know. And so in order to write, I have to search and to work and to travel like Sindibad. You know, the classical image of the storyteller comes from 1001 Nights. Sindibad used to travel and then to come back to Baghdad and then began relating the stories, the adventures that he went through. So, for me, writing is a kind of travel towards others, towards new experiences, and towards discovering the depth of the human experience and the human nature. And in this sense, this study, this discovery of this small community, which is still a very small community in Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine, was for me a book which I had to read it from the beginning, and which of course changed a lot in me. It changed my relationship to Arabic, and because you know when we speak a language, we think that this language was since eternity, which is not true. There is no language which began with eternity, and there is no language which will not die. So it makes things relative for me, although, of course, I love this language because this is my language. Everybody thinks his language is the best language because it's the mother tongue, because everybody of us thinks that his mother is the best mother in the world, which is the natural thing. So, but you make it relative, and then you discover the nuances in it, which helped me in my work to use the different scales of language, that is going from classical Arabic to colloquial, to the spoken, and using the syntax of the spoken in the structure of the classical, and so on and so forth.
Sinan, did you find something akin to that when you translated your language into English? Did it in some way expand your relationship to the language?
I cannot add much, but my situation is different in that none of the characters. I mean, actually, the character of the grandmother, who is based on my aunt, spoke Aramaic at home, and that kind of influences the character. But I didn't use it in the novel itself. But what my novel has, which only a few other Iraqi novels have, is that it has the variety of the dialects that we have in Iraq, because most Christians, not all of them, but most Christians happen to come from the northern part, and the northern part of Iraq has a different dialect, and that shows in the Arabic. Unfortunately, in the English, we could not reproduce that, because we have the modern standard Arabic, which is the narration, and then the dialogue, you have two different dialects. It doesn't come out, unfortunately, in the English, so that's lost, which is always the loss of some loss takes place with every translation. So
right, I'm wondering if you could. I know you have this new book of poems out. Could you recite a poem in the language that you wrote? Did you write them in English or did you write them in Arabic?
No, I always write most the poetry and the prose is in Arabic, and then I translate it into English. But so
could you recite something
In Arabic?
Yeah, from the new book or from the
book. Okay. a short poem called Hurub. حين مزقتني الحرب أخذت ريشة مبللة بالموت ورسمت على جدار الحرب نافذة فتحتها بحثا عن غد أو أي شيء لكني رأيت حربا أخرى وأما تنسج كفنا لقتيل ما زال في رحمها. Whatever that means. It sounds good.
Thank you.
Sounds excellent.
Merci.
Why don't we let that lie? Another question?
Sinan, I think your name is. The last excerpt that you read were the letters of the Arabic alphabet come to life, and they become animated. They pick up dots and wear them. What inspired you to this? Was it a dream, or did you imagine it, or how did you come to image that?
Ilyas said something about how terrifying writing is, and that, in a way, I was lucky in that while I was trying to reveal the anxiety and fear that a prisoner who is writing inside the cell, he fears that he's going to be discovered and then tortured further. But also injected into all of that is actually the fear of writing itself, in that, like the prisoner in a way, I think most writers struggle with this, wondering if what they put on the page is going to matter or is going to be read by anyone. So it wasn't a dream or anything, but it was my own struggle with the white page and thinking of how to you know, stitch these words together and make something out of them, but just also thinking about the language and thinking about if one had to write without dots. Later I discovered, like we always do, is that someone always has come before and said something similar to what you've said. So after I showed the novel to a friend, actually, it seems that, it turns out that one of the greatest, great writers in the Arabic tradition, Ibn Arabi, who's a great Sufi mystic who wrote numerous books, has an episode where he dreams and imagines that he marries each and every letter of the language, of the Arabic language. But I had not read that before writing the novel. But it's just about the anxiety of writing and the fear of facing the white page. When I was a teenager, I read a quote by an Egyptian novelist who said that writing is the most difficult craft in the world. And at the time, I laughed. I said, ha-ha. That's so silly. But actually, since that day, and every time I try to write, whether it's academic or creative, I'm reminded of that quote, because it is a very terrible thing while you're doing it. It's good to have written always, but it's a terrible thing to have to write, I think.
I wonder if, by way of closing out the evening, you could each recommend a book to us by an Arab writer that is available in English that you think, in addition to your own work, that we ought to take a look at.
Please.
Doesn't have to be just one.
There are so many books that I want to recommend, and I'll use this to say some things that, and we always talk about this. It's really disturbing how little interest there is in general in this country in international literature, but specifically literature from the Middle East. There are islands and places and publishing houses, but it's not just in literature. I mean, there was a report last year about how the number of foreign films is decreasing in this country, and after 9/11 you would think that there would be more interest. There is, but it's the kind of interest that I call forensic interest, which is the wrong kind of interest in a culture. And as I like to always tell my students on the first day of class, because I teach classes that have to do with literature, that if you're here to understand 9/11, you should drop this course right now, because our interest in other cultures always has an objective, but it shouldn't be this kind of forensic interest so that it explains 9/11. Because to explain 9/11, you have to read about history and foreign policy. Not that literature doesn't help humanize dehumanized cultures and people, but there are so many books I would like to recommend. I think actually a novel by a Palestinian writer, Ghassan Kanafani, called Men Under the Sun is a very powerful Men in the Sun. Sorry, I'm translating from English. It's translated into English, translated from Arabic. But it's a very powerful novella on every level, you know, aesthetically and politically. And I highly recommend that. And it's short. I know we live in the soundbite age, so...
To continue what Sinan began, actually I will recommend a book of poetry written by Mahmoud Darwish entitled Why Did You Leave the Horse Alone? I think this book, I love it in a very special way, because it's a kind of a poetic autobiography of the Palestinian Nakba, of the Palestinian catastrophe of 1948. And since the whole world is commemorating this year the 60th anniversary of the birth of the State of Israel, we must remember that the same 60th anniversary is the day where the Palestinians lost their country. And their Nakba and catastrophe took place, where they were expelled from their country. So this book, which is a very sensible, beautifully written book of poetry, is a kind of, as I said, a personal autobiography about this time of the catastrophe. And with this, Khaled, we thank you.
Yes, and thank you to our readers, Elias Khoury and Sinan Antoun. Please join us upstairs. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information is available at freelibrary.org.